Last week, we discussed how the tribes were arranged into divisions, and they were placed in a precise pecking order surrounding the wilderness tabernacle. And then the connection between the symbols of the tribes of Israel with these strange spiritual creatures that the Bible sometimes calls just living beings, who we're told surrounded God's throne. We saw that the 12 tribes of Israel were directed by God to be organized into four divisions of three tribes each, and one of the tribes of each of those divisions was designated as that division's leader tribe. And further, the four divisions were to occupy specific areas outside of the tabernacle as defined by the points of a compass, east, west, north, south. Now, the symbols of these four leader tribes were a lion, an ox or a bull, an eagle, and a man, a human. And when we examined the books of Ezekiel and Revelation, lo and behold, we're told that these living beings who guarded Jehovah's heavenly throne and went with God wherever he went, had four faces. And guess what they were? A lion, an ox, an eagle, and a man. Therefore, we see that the reason that Israel was to encamp the way they did in conjunction with the wilderness tabernacle was so that it followed after the eternal pattern of the heavenly throne room. And this is a wonderful example of what I have labeled the reality of duality, whereby every spiritual principle has a physical, earthly counterpart, and vice versa. Let's read Exodus chapter 25 together, and let's see the beginning instructions for the construction of the wilderness tabernacle, God's earthly dwelling place. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 88. This is Exodus chapter 25. Adonai said to Moshe, "Tell the people of Israel to take up a collection for me. Accept a contribution from anyone who wholeheartedly wants to give. The contribution you are to take from them is to consist of gold, silver, and bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, fine linen, goat's hair, tanned ram skins, fine leather, acacia wood, oil for the light, spices for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense, onyx stones and other stones to be set for the ritual vest and breastplate. They are to make me a sanctuary so that I may live among them. You are to make it according to everything I show you, the design of the tabernacle and the design of its furnishings. This is how you are to make it. They are to make an ark of acacia wood, 3 3/4 feet long, 2 1/4 feet wide, and 2 1/4 feet high. You are to overlay it with pure gold. Overlay it both inside and outside and put a molding of gold around the top of it. Cast 4 gold rings for it and attach them to 4 feet, 2 rings on each side. Make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. Put the poles into the rings of the side of the ark. You will use them to carry the ark. The poles are to remain in the rings of the ark. They are not to be removed from it. Into the ark you are to put the testimony, which I am about to give you. You are to make a cover for the ark out of pure gold. It is to be 3 3/4 feet long, 2 1/4 feet wide, and you are to make 2 cherubim, that's cherubim, out of gold. Make them of hammered work for the 2 ends of the ark cover. Make 1 cherub for 1 end and 1 cherub for the other end, and make the cherubim of 1 piece with the ark cover at its 2 ends. The cherubs will have their wings spread out above so that their wings cover the ark. And their faces are towards each other and towards the ark cover. You are to put the ark cover on top of the ark. Inside the ark, you will put the testimony that I'm about to give you. There I will meet with you. I will speak with you from above the ark cover, from between the two cherubim, which are on the ark for the testimony, about all the orders I am giving you for the people of Israel. You are to make a table of acacia wood, 3 feet long, 18 inches wide, 18 inches high, and overlay it with pure gold and put a molding of gold around the top of it. Make around it a rim, a hand breadth wide, and put a molding of gold around the rim. Make 4 gold rings for it and attach the rings to the 4 corners near its 4 legs. The rings to hold the poles used to carry the table are to be placed close to the rim. Make the poles of acacia wood, overlay them with gold, and use them to carry the table. Make its dishes, pans, bowls, and pitchers of pure gold. On the table you are to place the bread of the presence, in my presence always. You are to make a menorah of pure gold. It is to be made of hammered work. Its base, shaft, cups, ring of outer leaves, and petals are to be of one piece with it. It is to have 6 branches extending from its sides, 3 branches of the menorah on one side of it, 3 on the other. On one branch are to be 3 cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with a ring of outer leaves and petals. Likewise, on the opposite branch, 3 cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with a ring of outer leaves and petals. And similarly, for all 6 branches extending from the menorah. On the central shaft of the menorah are to be 4 cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with its ring of outer leaves and petals. Where each pair of branches joins the central shaft is to be a ring of outer leaves of one piece with the pair of branches, thus for all 6 branches. The rings of outer leaves and their branches are to be of one piece with the shaft. Thus the whole menorah is to be a single piece of hammered work made of pure gold. Make 7 lamps for the menorah. Mount them so as to give light to the space in front of it. Its tongs and trays are to be made of pure gold. The menorah and its utensils are to be made of 66 pounds of pure gold. See that you make them according to the design being shown to you on the mountain. Notice something interesting. Before the blueprint of the tabernacle is given, we're first given the construction details of several of the pieces of sacred furniture and of the sacred instruments. So the instructions regarding the building of the tabernacle begin, in essence, from the inside and work their way outward. Jehovah's instructions begin with the holiest, which is the ark, then next move to the merely holy, that's the menorah, the table of showbread, and the altar of incense. And then they finally move out of the sanctuary tent and into the area of humanity, the courtyard area outside the tent, where the sacrificial altar is located. And we're going to examine all of this in detail. In verse 1, God tells Moses that he wants Moses to collect the materials needed for the tabernacle from the Israelite population, but only from those who are willing to give without being coerced. No guilt is to be laid on them. This is to be an offering. It's a contribution. Nothing is to be given for any other reason than a person wants to give it. Notice that there is no penalty, or is there to be any peer pressure, guilt, shame applied to the people of Israel in order to give. There is no grand emotional speech by Moses or God that has been left to us as a model to start the building fund. The need is stated. Then the giving either comes from the people's hearts or it doesn't come at all. However, the tabernacle is for the benefit of the entire community of Israel. It is reasonably expected that all will contribute to one level or another. I want to tell you a story. Some of you know about all this. Many years ago, before Love Israel, Baruch's ministry became part of Seed of Abraham, I was in Israel And I asked Baruch, what could we do to help his ministry? He said they really badly need a place to meet. I came back, talked to the board. They said, let's go. So I got a committee of people and said, okay, how are we going to raise this money? We were going to need about, we figured somewhere near $350,000. And so we came up with all kinds of ideas for everything from bake sales to, you know how that works. And I thought about it and I prayed about it. And we were right about this section of Exodus when all this was happening. And I thought, no, we're just going to express the need. We're going to put information on the website, and that's it. This is what we need. This is what we're going to do. We figured it would take us about 2 years to raise the money. It came in 5.5 months. And no guilt, no nothing. It was just people that wanted to give from their hearts. This is why you don't have a silver plate placed in front of you and passed around. You don't have a bucket up here on the stage and a horn that blows when you put money in it. Well, you laugh, but this happens. Okay? Because I truly believe that every one of you knows what you're supposed to do. You know. It's between you and God whether you do it or you don't. And I just want, the reason I'm telling you this is that this principle that God showed Moses right here, watch what happens as we go along with him as well. When God says, don't put the guilt on anybody, don't coerce anybody, all right? They don't get anything special, they don't get a free DVD, all right, for giving $100, they don't get any of this. Just ask for it and leave it be. It's interesting to watch. Well, in Hebrew thinking, as regards giving, there is more than one kind of offering. This particular kind of offering is called a terumah, which is sometimes translated in our Bibles as a heave offering, not a very nice sounding thing. It has the sense of being a contribution. That is, the giver is contributing to a need or to a common cause. Now, this strange-sounding term, heave offering, doesn't mean that makes you sick in you. Okay. It's actually descriptive of the way that the offering is presented to God. By ritual tradition, this offering was literally raised up above the shoulder by the priest and moved about in a motion like this. Like one was heaving, underhanded, a bag of grain. And this kind of offering, this terumah, was not a sacrifice, per se. Because sacrifices were not only required actions in order to remediate some violation of the law or to complete some type of celebration or covenant ritual. But most, though not all, sacrifices were burned up on the altar. Sacrifices required the giving of an animal or grain or wine or money according to some legally prescribed amount and then a particular kind of sacrifice. The terumah had this element of free will, of choice behind it. Now, I could easily turn this into a lesson about our giving or our tithing. I think I'll resist that for now. The truth is, like I said before, you all know what you're supposed to do. This is not an issue of what should you do. This is an issue of obedience. So I'll say this. I think we need to remember that all attempts by Christian authorities to characterize our giving or our tithing as simply a New Testament version of the Old Testament sacrificial system is misguided, and it is not at all biblically supported. Sacrificing is sacrificing. An offering is an offering. And they're entirely two different things, different in purpose, different in nature. Yeshua has already satisfied every requirement of the Torah sacrificial system once and for all. So our giving, our tithing, cannot ever be classified as a sacrifice. Rather, the God principle about our giving is set down for us right here in the first verse of Exodus 25. It is the equivalent to the free will terumah, the heave offering. We either give for a common cause with a joyful heart, freely, out of obedience and gratitude for what Jehovah's done for us, because we recognize the need and our duty to contribute, or we shouldn't do it at all. But the type of giving the church does, we do within our church, is not in the realm of sacrifice. It's a privilege. It's a duty. It comes out of an act of conscience. Now, before we read more and study more about the construction and the blueprint of the tabernacle, which can admittedly get a little bit tedious, I want to show you about a half-hour video which better illustrates the pattern of the tabernacle, the materials it used, its implements, its furniture, and then where everything was placed. I think once you have that picture in your minds, it's going to be a lot more understandable when we read more about it and we study more about it. So, with that, let's go ahead and start the movie. Now today, we're going to be looking at some of those individual pieces of furniture, all right, that's far more than just simply decoration. Please note as we proceed that the construction materials used for the tabernacle are grouped into seven categories: metals, dyed yarn, fabric, timber, oil, spices, and gemstones. And as Nahum Sarna, who's a wonderful Torah scholar, as noted, there is a very interesting feature about some of the fabrics that will be used, because at times these fabrics consist of a mixture of wool and linen. Now, that probably didn't mean too much to you now, but it will when we study Leviticus. The reason is that such a fabric mixture is usually prohibited. In Hebrew, that kind of mixture of two kinds of material to make a piece of cloth is called shatnez. Now, clothing, for example, is generally not to be made of material of this kind of mixed fibers. Yet we're going to find that the veil that separates the Holy of Holies from the rest of the sanctuary, the curtain at the entry into the tent sanctuary, even parts of the high priest's ritual clothing are all required to be made of this mixture, this shatnez, that is otherwise forbidden. Now, what we learn from this is that there are certain things that are reserved for the most holy, as designated by Jehovah, and its use outside of that context alone is not allowed. Therefore, there is nothing inherently unholy or impure about mixed fabrics. You don't put them together and suddenly you get wicked fabric. It doesn't create some kind of a magical interaction. This understanding is the key to correctly comprehending the principles behind everything from kosher eating versus impure foods to the designation of clean versus unclean animals, or better, prohibited and permitted animals. It's a mistake to think that any food or any animal has some type of inborn, organic, or systematic holiness, while another food or animal has some type of inborn, organic, or systematic impurity in it. Rather, in general, the status or classification has to do with God's sovereign determination and inscrutable decisions about what and how ritual and worship before him to occur. It's really that simple. Now, before we start examining the tabernacle's furnishings, I want to highlight verse 9 of chapter 25 of Exodus. It says, "You are to make it according to everything I show you, the design of the tabernacle, the design of the furnishings." This was Jehovah talking to Moses during Moses' 40 days on top of Mount Sinai. Moses, at this point in chapter 25, has not yet come back down the mountain to the people. Now, many versions will translate this verse as, "Make it according to the pattern I show you," and that is certainly accurate. But the question is, of course, what pattern is God showing to Moses? Has Jehovah already rolled out a blueprint on a papyrus scroll and showing Moses the finer details of an earthly tent? No. Jehovah is giving Moses a tour of God's heavenly dwelling place. Okay, remember, the tabernacle in Hebrew, Mishkan, is just an expression meaning dwelling place. The pattern Moses was to follow to build the wilderness tabernacle was God's spiritual tabernacle, his throne room, his dwelling place, which, by the way, all refers to the same thing, in heaven. Moses' vision of the spiritual tabernacle was to be transformed into a working model, a copy, but it was to be developed now in the physical realm. So, is this just nice-sounding allegory or theory on my part? Or is there more evidence that the heavenly was indeed the pattern being talked about here? Listen to Hebrews 8:5. "But what they are serving is only a copy and a shadow of the heavenly original. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, God warned him, 'See to it that you make everything according to the pattern you were shown on the mountaintop.'" Hebrews 8 and 9 spend some time making comparisons between the heavenly and the earthly, using the tabernacle and the sacrificial system to make its point. But these same chapters also point out a principle that can easily get flip-flopped or just kind of bypassed in our minds, and it is this. Oh boy, this is important. The physical is by nature inferior to the spiritual. The physical by nature is inferior to the spiritual. That is, what exists in the spirit world is far more superior in its capabilities, its perfection, its purity, than what's even possible in the physical world. For instance, the tabernacle and all of its services, while real and God-ordained, are just copies. But they're inferior copies of the real, original heavenly tabernacle, which, of course, existed before and then simultaneously with the earthly tabernacle. The Bible uses the term shadows to compare the earthly to the heavenly, like it was a shadow of things to come. And it does that when describing many of the elements of the tabernacle and the prophecies and the law. It's referring to the fact that compared to the spiritual, original, the physical copy simply can't match up. It can't provide the depth of reality that the real thing can do. Leonardo da Vinci can paint a breathtaking picture of Mount Everest, perhaps as nobody else ever could, but it can never compare to standing there viewing the real Mount Everest. The painting is a shadow of the real thing. The physical world is very limiting because it's governed by the laws of physics. And contained within a universe of space and time. The spiritual operates outside of all those limitations and laws. So every element of the tabernacle, its rooms, its materials, its design, its furniture, the sacrificial system, everything was patterned after the heavenly original and look forward towards the time when through Messiah, mankind would be able to experience the limitless spiritual reality of its meaning instead of the limited nature of just mere physical copies. Now let's look at some of the awesome connections and symbolism of a general nature about the tabernacle. First of all, notice how it's laid out. The same way that the geographical area of Mount Sinai was laid out. See, the mountain and the tabernacle were each divided into three zones. The mountain of Sinai, Mount Sinai and the tabernacle were each divided into three zones of varying degrees of holiness. The mountain was holy, all of it. There was a stone fence, a boundary marker, at the base of the mountain that separated the holy mountain from the valley floor below, the holy area from the area the people could congregate. The entirety of Mount Sinai equates to the tabernacle sanctuary. And the sanctuary consisted of two connected rooms, the holy place and the holy of holies. The summit of Mount Sinai was where the Spirit of God rested, up there in the cloud that burned like a raging fire. Only one person was allowed to come into that area. And only when he was summoned by God. That was Moses. The summit of the mountain was the equivalent of the Holy of Holies, whereby only the high priest could ever enter. No one else. And then only one day a year. The mountain slope was equivalent to the holy place in the tent sanctuary. The slope of Mount Sinai was where God called Moses and the 70 elders, the people's representatives, plus Aaron and his two sons to come and have the covenant feast, the covenant meal before him. They had to come over the barrier line that separated the holy from everything else, that stone fence, which up to now, people were not allowed to cross. But because of the sacrifice on the altar, which sealed down this covenant, and the blood of that sacrificed animal, which was sprinkled on the people, and therefore ceremonially atoned for and covered their sin, God now allows these 74 people who represent all Israel, Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and 70 elders, allows them to come up to the holy mountain. However, not to the summit. They cannot go to the summit. They cannot go to the top that is the equivalent of the Holy of Holies. They have to stay on the slope, which is the holy place, a zone of less holiness, but still holy. The valley floor side of the rock fence barrier, that was where the Hebrew people could congregate. It was the zone of humanity, but only for God's set apart people, only for people who are redeemed. It's also where God instructed Moses to build a stone altar on which the sacrifices to seal the Mosaic covenant were to be made. The valley floor area was equivalent to the outer court of the tabernacle, where the sacrificial bronze altar was to be built, where the redeemed people of God could come to offer up their sacrifices. So we see this sameness of pattern in every place that God dwells. His heavenly tabernacle was the model for every one of his earthly dwelling places, starting with the Garden of Eden, then Mount Sinai, then the wilderness tabernacle, and finally its replacement, the temple. Now I want to go off on a little bit of a tangent to show you another fascinating connection. 400 years earlier, Yehovah brought the infant tribe of Israel from Canaan into Egypt in order to survive a famine. Israel went on to live and multiply greatly into a huge nation there. When Joseph, who's the favored son of Jacob, when he was the governor of Egypt, and Jacob moved his entire clan to Egypt at Joseph's invitation to begin anew, do you recall how many people were told made up the clan of Israel? Counting Joseph and his family, 74. The same precise number of Israelites that God called up to his holy mountain to consecrate another new beginning for Israel. This time as a full-fledged set-apart nation for himself. Now please be aware, there were definitely more than 74 Israelites that journeyed from Canaan down into Egypt. Exactly how many came, we don't know. But we do know that sometime before Israel moved to Egypt, there was at least one instance in which a sizable number of people were added to Jacob's nation when at Shechem, Jacob's sons led a raid of revenge on that city's inhabitants in revenge for the king's son raping Dinah. Those sons killed all the males inside Shechem and took all the women and children as slaves. And since this was just standard operating procedure for all Middle Eastern cultures of that day, it's quite likely that other similar incidents occurred, maybe not on as big a scale, in which individuals were captured in order to increase the size of the fledgling Israelite nation. The 74 Israelites spoken of as coming to Egypt, this represented the entire nation that entered Egypt, just as the 74 Israelites that God called to come up to his mountain represented the Israelite nation that left Egypt. Well, Moses erected 12 standing stones, 12 monuments, at the base of Mount Sinai to represent the 12 tribes of Israel before God. And accordingly, God instructed that there is to be a table in the tabernacle with 12 loaves of showbread on it at all times, representing the 12 tribes of Israel before him. Inside the two separate rooms of the sanctuary, the holy place and the holy of holies, all the fixtures were to be made of gold. And this symbolizes holiness and purity. Outside the sanctuary, in the outer court, all the fixtures were to be made of bronze and less valuable materials. I'm going to mention one more thing. As you saw from that video, and as you have seen and will see from the scriptures, the tabernacle contained no images of Jehovah God. None. The religion of Jehovah was to be an imageless religion. The second of the Ten Commandments made it very clear that God wants no images of his person to be made. The religion of the Hebrews was the first, to the best of my knowledge, along with its offshoot Christianity, it remains the only religion in which its God says no images of him are to be made. We need to think long and hard about this and our penchant for images and symbols. Next week, we're going to examine the very first item God instructed to be made from the contributions, the terumah, from the people, and that's the Ark of the Covenant.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.